Wonderful. So it's my privilege to share with you this morning part three in our series, Who is God? The last couple of weeks we've been introducing this, and let me just give this a quick recap. What I said 2 weeks ago was what comes to mind when we think about God informs our perspective on many other aspects of our lives. This question, who is God? Is not just a philosophical or theoretical question, but it actually influences our thinking and then our actions and our behavior. Whether we're new to Christianity, whether we've been Christians for many years or just started exploring, I believe it's vitally important for each of us to ask this question, who is God? And in this series, the basis of for our approach to understanding this question is to go to a place. And that place is Mount Sinai. And we're going to listen in on a conversation between God and a man called Moses that we've just heard a few moments ago. Because in this incredible moment, we hear not what other people say about God, but what God declares himself about himself. Up until this point in the Bible story, we've only heard what other people have to say about God. But in this moment, God himself speaks. And it's fascinating. He doesn't start with a list of attributes, but he starts with his name. Why is this important for us? Well, Bob explained wonderfully last week, go back and listen again on Facebook or download the podcast if you missed it, that names in the Bible are always significant and packed with meaning. And God's name is no different. We discovered that God has a name, and it's not God, it's Yahweh. Bob talked about the fact that this name is unique and reverent, but it's also personal. God was no longer to only known, but be known by a title, but to be known with a personal name. In other words, he can be known and he wants to be known. Remember, what we think about God informs our behavior and our response. And Bob talked about prayer. Just imagine, I was thinking of this illustration this week, that if you walked into a large room like the one on the screen, filled with people, and either the Queen or, say, the Prime Minister were in that room, if you, like me, stood at the back, I would think to myself, I'll just keep quiet. I don't know them, whether it's neither the Queen or the Prime Minister, and they're not going to be interested anyway in my thoughts, my questions, or my observations. That's because I don't have any relationship with either the Queen or the Prime Minister. I know the Queen as Her Royal Highness and the Prime Minister as, well, Prime Minister. But if I knew them by name, the conversation would be very different because the relationship would be very different. And it's the same with God. God declared his name as Yahweh. It's personal. It means that when we pray, it's a personal conversation. And Yahweh listens and Yahweh responds. So last week on our journey to discover who is God, we said God has a name and it's not God, it's Yahweh. And this week I'm going to look at the next part. Remember this Bible passage, Yahweh, Yahweh, the compassionate and gracious God. So last week we looked at Yahweh. And this week I'm really excited to talk to you about, wait for it, Yahweh. But don't switch off, it's not a repeat of last week, there's more. So the first question we need to ask is, why does God, or Yahweh, repeat himself? Well, in our modern world, if you're writing a book or an email or even a text and you want to emphasize something, we have different ways of doing it, don't we? We can underline it. We can put our text in bold. We can put our text in capital letters, or we can do all three. But in the ancient world, if you wanted to drive home your point, you would repeat it. Let me say that again. If you wanted to drive home a point, you would repeat it. See what I did there? So when Yahweh says his name, not once, but twice, it's his way of saying he wants us to slow down and think and go a bit deeper. So let's do that this morning. Why does God need a name in the first place? What's wrong with God? In fact, why is God rarely called God in the original Bible text anyway? Why is he usually called Yahweh or Yahweh God? The short answer, and this is actually very important, is this: because there were many different gods. Let's think about that a little bit more. It's important. At the very start of the Bible, if you turn to the first page in Genesis, the opening line says this: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the Hebrew, the word God is Elohim, and it's not a name, it's a category. It's used to describe the creator of the universe, but it's also used for all sorts of other spiritual beings. And Elohim is the name given for any invisible but real spiritual creature. And what we probably don't appreciate was that in ancient times there were a number of theories of how the earth was created. Many people believe that the universe was created in the aftermath of a giant cosmic conflict between the gods, with a little g. So the early Bible characters that we read about in our modern translations lived in a world where there wasn't one God, but many gods. So the claim of the Christian Bible that there is one true creator God who made everything is radically out of step with the thinking of the time. And the idea that the world wasn't born out of conflict or war or fighting between the gods, but the overflow of Yahweh's creativity and love, was not the common view. So we understand that on one hand, there's Yahweh, God, the uncreated creator of everything, uncreated creator of everything, and a being with no parallel in the universe. And on the other hand, there's the gods who were created invisible but spiritual beings. You can see that on the screen, those two things, Yahweh and the gods. Let's look at an example. Earlier in the book of Exodus, in the Moses story, we read about Yahweh saving Israel, God's people, out of slavery in Egypt. And there's an interesting line in chapter 12 when Yahweh says, "I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt." Now, you may or may not know that in order to carry out this freedom from slavery plan, there's a story about 10 plagues that come upon the people. Frogs and blood and locusts. It's quite a story. If you've never read it, you should go back and look it up. But did you know that many of the plagues were directed at specific Egyptian gods? No, me neither. For example, Amun-Ra was the sun god in the Egyptian world, but Amun-Ra was also seen to be the king over all the other Egyptian deities. So what does Yahweh do in the story? Well, he blots out the sun. For 3 days, it's pitch black. It's the equivalent of a, yeah, in your face Egyptian god, or another way of saying, Yahweh saying, Amun-Ra isn't the king of the gods, I am. And a few chapters later in the story, a first-hand observer of this freedom from slavery story comments, "Now I know that the Lord, Yahweh, is greater than all other gods, for he did this to those who had treated Israel arrogantly." Notice, all other gods. And what's Israel's response to Yahweh saving them from Egypt and its many other gods? Well, Israel's response, God's people's response, was worship. We read this song of praise in the Exodus story. "Who among the gods is like you, Yahweh? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonder?" So, because Yahweh is in a class all by himself, and because he saved Israel out of slavery, he is the one and only Elohim deserving of worship. And notice this reoccurring theme in the language throughout the Israel's people after that. For example, look in Psalm 86. It says this: "Among the gods, there is none like you, Yahweh. No deeds can compare with yours." Or in Psalm 96, it says this. I love Psalm 96. It says, "Great is the Lord," or "Great is Yahweh, and most worthy of praise. He is to be feared above all gods." Or one step further, listen to Psalm 97. It says this, and this is fascinating: "Worship him, all you gods, for you, Yahweh, are the most high over all the earth. You are exalted far above all gods. So even the other gods are to worship Yahweh. Why? Because he is the Most High. In other words, in the hierarchy of gods, Yahweh is at the top in his own category, and he still is. You doing okay? Stick with me. Let's go a little bit further. You've probably heard of the Ten Commandments, the guidelines that Yahweh gave to Moses to help the people live best. The first one was this: you shall have no other gods before me. Lots of people skip over this, thinking other gods, they're all, aren't they just made up figments of imagination? But this seems like a dangerous assumption to make if Yahweh considered them to be in his top 10. Not to worship other gods ever. In the story with the plagues, Moses demonstrates that he is the messenger from Yahweh by performing miracles. But Pharaoh's magicians do exactly the same. So the other gods clearly aren't figments of imagination because they had powers and they did things. Then look at the second commandment. You must not make for yourself an idol of any kind or an image of anything in the heavens or in the earth or the sea. You must not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. We don't have time to go into lots of details this morning, but notice this. There are gods and there are idols, and Yahweh warns against both. There are lots of different examples. We don't have time to go into them this morning, but in the Old Testament, time after time, there's the tragic story of God's people. And what happens is there's a warning not to worship other gods, but it falls on deaf ears. Over and over again, the nation Israel is distracted or led astray and goes over to other gods of other nations. And all things change in the New Testament, as we'll see in a minute, but still also the same thread, even in the New Testament, is coming through. The Apostle Paul, speaking to one of the early churches, says this: for even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, or as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom all things come and for whom we live. So notice, Paul is still talking about other gods and other lords. And Paul is still distinguishing between the one God, now with the name Father, but still the same Yahweh, and the other gods. Now, maybe I'm labouring the point, but I want you to see and I want you to be aware that there are other spiritual forces that exist in the world. In our Western society, we are less aware, but go to India or other places in the East and it's very different. I was listening to my friend Richard Bradbury, who travels to India frequently, and he was describing the completely different spiritual landscape in India, where there are literally dozens, if not hundreds, of gods that are recognised and worshipped. And our friend John Hallett could tell you stories similar too. And throughout the Bible, there are many different references to other spiritual forces or beings. Of course, you've probably heard of angels and demons, but also we find references to heavenly beings, powers, principalities, rulers, powers of this dark world, and evil spirits, amongst others. And we see in the Old Testament, it's like the story on repeat, with a nagging sense of déjà vu, stuck in a cycle. Israel goes after the other gods. It goes badly. They ask for mercy and Yahweh comes to save them. This seems to happen, if you read through the Old Testament narrative, about a bajillion times. Then there's a prayer that rises to the surface, a prayer to Yahweh to end the wickedness of these evil powers, to drive them out, to put a stop to their havoc and set the world free. This is, of course, where Jesus comes in. Our series is called Who is God? And each week we will unashamedly be turning to Jesus to help understand and answer that question. Bob said it well last week, that Jesus is the embodiment of Yahweh himself, the in flesh and blood human, but also divine representation of the Creator God. And as the New Testament writers look back on Jesus' life, death and resurrection, they make it clear that one of Jesus' primary purposes was to disarm the powers at war with Yahweh. Listen to three different records from three different writers of the New Testament. First up is John. He says, the reason the Son of God came was to destroy the works of the devil. Second up is Luke. He says, God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and power, and he went around doing good and healing all who were under the power of the devil. And finally, Gospel writer Mark, famous for being direct and to the point, he says, that's Jesus, traveled through Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. So Jesus' mission was very clear. He had come once and for all to defeat the powers of evil and dark spiritual forces that exist in the world. Just 3 weeks ago was Easter Sunday, when we remembered and celebrated the death and the resurrection of Jesus. For a brief moment, it looked like Yahweh had lost the war. Think about it. His son is hanging on a cross, the life gone from his body. It feels like it's the end. But we know the story. 3 days later, the tomb is empty and Jesus is alive. His resurrection breaks the power of death itself, not through violence, but through sacrificial love. The Apostle Paul sums it up this way. Having disarmed the power and authorities, he, Jesus, made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. Made a public spectacle of them. Not just victorious, but literally rubbing their faces in it. The theological term for this, which I think I referred to on Easter Sunday, is substitutionary atonement. Let's say that together. Substitutionary atonement. Big words, but in simple terms, it means that Jesus died as the substitute in our place to make us right with God. This is one of the most important metaphors in the New Testament for what happened through Jesus' death and resurrection. But the other one, which was actually up until the last 500 years, was actually the more dominant metaphor in Christians' thinking, was called Christus Victor, which means Christ is victorious. And put in simple terms, this means Yahweh has been at war with the spiritual powers of the universe for millennia, but the cross is the decisive and final blow in his campaign against evil. This is incredible. It's the breakthrough victory on the cross where Jesus defeated Satan and, notice, all the other gods once and for all. You may not remember the term Christus Victor, but I hope you'll remember this reality because it's so significant to our understanding. We heard Dave Smith from Kingsgate explain it well. This coming Friday is a bank holiday to remember and commemorate VE Day, during being the day that the World War II was finally over. But exactly one year before the Allied forces retook the beaches in France, which effectively meant that Hitler and the Nazis regime were done. But it was 1 year and 1 day of further fighting and bloodshed before the war was finally over. D-Day was to World War II what Jesus' death and resurrection were in the war against the evil powers. We live between D-Day and VE Day, between Jesus' first coming to land the decisive blow to all of the evil powers and his second coming to end for once and for all evil for good. And in the meantime, as Jesus' followers, our job is to stand in that victory, to hold our ground and to cooperate with heaven's invasion of earth. Yes, we fight, but our fight isn't with swords or spears or bullets. It's with prayer and sacrificial love. John Mark Comer says it this way. So don't join a militia or go to war. Get on your knees and give your life away. I love that. And we should. So, final question this morning. What's all this got to do with us? Well, good question, and thanks for asking. Well, hopefully you've already picked up what I've already said has got to do with us. It's incredible and important for our understanding and therefore our thinking and our behaviour. But let me finish by making two final comments. One about evil and one about idols. First, evil. If everything we've looked at this morning is true, then it gives us some important understanding about evil. Many people find it incredibly hard to understand that if there's a God who is all-loving and all-powerful, why is there still evil in the world? Ever asked that? It's a big question. How can we reconcile the shooting, the terrorist bombing, the abuse with a creator God who is compassionate and gracious? That's next week. Well, if we look in the Bible, we actually, interestingly, don't see lots of answers to this question. And the reason we don't see them is because evil is basically assumed. In Jesus' central prayer that he teaches his disciples, he says, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." In other words, it's clear that God's will was not done on earth then or now. Heaven is the place where God's will is done all of the time. But here on earth, on the other hand, this is the place where God's will is done only some of the time. Difficult to get your heads around, right? And I understand there's plenty of mystery involved here. But God isn't the only one with a will. Human beings have a will, and as we've seen, so do other spiritual beings. Hence, the evil that we see around us, we see on the news, we see nationally, we see internationally, there is evil in the world. And to be really clear, it's not that God's will is weak or on an even playing field with all the other wills. It's that in the universe that God has chosen to create, love is the highest value, and love demands a choice, and a choice demands freedom. Finally, one quick thought on idols. It's not just the Old Testament writers that talk about staying away from idolatry. It's referenced plenty of times in the New Testament as well, which tells us it's still an issue even after Jesus. In our world, if you go to the right places, you'll still find idols made out of wood or metal or stone. In and of themselves, they could be harmless, but often they open up a gateway to a spiritual force or power, and they can have a real impact. In our secular society, the gods or idols become something different. Money, sex, power, sport, celebrity, social media, and many others. Maybe in the last 6 weeks when we've been without many things, we've recognised things that probably had a higher priority in people's lives than they should have done. The theologian N.T. Wright, one of the great minds of our time, probably explains it best, like he does most things. He says this: when we humans commit idolatry, worshipping that which is not God as if it were, we thereby give to our other creatures and beings in the cosmos a power, a prestige, an authority over us, which we, under God, were supposed to have over them. When you worship an idol, whatever it is, you abdicate something of your own proper human authority over the world and give it instead to that thing, whatever it is. Genius words. The truth is that we are all made to worship. It's the way that we're created. Everybody worships something or someone. The choice we have, that we get to choose, is what to worship. So we've deliberately gone a bit deeper today. Hopefully you stuck with me. Let's remember, there are many gods, but only one true creator God. His name is Yahweh. And he made the world and everything good and everything beautiful and everything true that's in it. He and he alone is deserving of worship. He's the only source of life and peace and meaning and significance that will last past death into forever. So today, let's love him with all your heart and soul and strength. Don't worship any of the other gods or idols. Worship him alone. Worship God, Yahweh. Amen.